Elizabeth said you're the maestro.
My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm here speaking with Matthew Scott Hansen. Can I call you Matt?
You can call me Matt.
Okay. Welcome to KBOO. Welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much.
The title of your book is The Shadow Killer, published by Simon & Schuster. But let's get right down to it. This is a book about Bigfoot.
It is indeed.
What does the last? It's not really a chapter of the book. It's kind of a your afterword.
Yeah.
For the book, you really are interested in Bigfoot. And
yes.
What's the basis of your interest in Bigfoot?
Well, that you've got this enormous creature running around in the woods, essentially, and we haven't really discovered it. Hasn't been cataloged by science.
So you're a believer.
Oh yeah, I believe they exist. Now, progenitor of what the modern Bigfoot is did exist at one time. So the people that asked the question, well, is it, you know, how could this thing be? The Bigfoot did exist. We know that to be a fact.
I was going to Google Gigantopithecus.
Exactly.
But I didn't do it. So tell us about Gigantopithecus. I guess that's the precursor.
Indeed. probably the where Gigantopithecus came into the eyes of science. Back in 1935 in Hong Kong, a paleontologist, a guy named Dr. Ralph von Koenigswald, a Dutchman, was poking around in apothecary shops in Hong Kong, and he was looking for interesting artifacts, and he found a tooth, and he asked the pharmacist what the tooth was, and the guy said, these are dragon's teeth, and they use them, they grind them up, and they use them for whatever. And he looked at this tooth, and he realized that it was a molar, but it was the biggest molar he'd ever seen. It was so enormous. The thing was about an inch square. And if you figure human molars may be, you know, how big a, you know, maybe a third of an inch. This thing was 10 times bigger.
It's like a cow's tooth.
Right. But he realized it was a molar of an upper primate. And he took out his loupe, took a look at it. And even though it was fossilized, he realized it was the real deal. And since then, they found a number of jawbone fragments, enough to be able to sort of recreate this creature, his eating habits, his size, his nature. And they found thousands of teeth since then, particularly in a couple of caves, I think, in southern China. And so they think that the Gigantopithecus, which existed from about the mid-Pleistocene area, maybe 400,000 years ago, and they think it might have gone extinct. They think it went extinct about 100,000 years ago. But there's too much evidence for its potential currency, I think. I think it still exists. I think some offshoot or something evolved from Gigantopithecus, and we've got it here in North America. The one in Asia.
The Yeti.
And there's many other names. The Chinese have one, the Yeren. Even the Australians have the Yowie. And Southeast Asia, all through what used to be French Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, all those countries, Malaysia. In fact, the Malaysian government hired a tracking team to go find these things because there had been so many sightings. It was disrupting business in certain areas. This was just in the last couple months. So the creatures there seem to look a little different. They seem to be of a different nature. They have what's called an opposed hallux. The big toe is more like an ape's toe, which is, and the one in North America, our Bigfoot has got a foot like ours, only it's a lot bigger.
The places where Yeti has been seen, or Sasquatch, as you call them, Oma in the book, I presume that's a Native American.
Oma, yeah, is a Hoopa Indian word.
They tend to be isolated, and before the last 50 years, say, the American Northwest woods was a pretty isolated place. Everything from here up to Alaska, right through British Columbia.
It really still is.
Yeah. In many ways it is. But of course, now we've got helicopters, and we've got hikers, and we've got snowmobiles, so it's less isolated than it used to be.
Yes.
The Himalayas is another place where people see them, which of course is still incredibly isolated.
Yes.
But Sherpas believe in it.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're the ones that run around up there all the time.
Yes.
I'm thinking of King Kong. And I'm thinking of the island that Kong came from that's still dinosaurs on it.
Yeah.
Do humans have a kind of an atavistic need to believe that these things still exist? Is there the great unconscious monster in the back of our mind that needs to be personified in some way?
I think there is, yeah. I think that even if this thing didn't exist, I think there is a psychology that explains that we do have a need for that You know, I'm not a psychologist, but they talk about such things coming from the id, you know, deep down in that part of our consciousness, that we do fear things in the dark. We fear things that can consume us, creatures like this that are so much bigger, so much more powerful than we are. I think there could be, although I do think the thing exists, and I think there's enough science to back it up. It's just, I think that a lot of people, there is a skepticism because you say, well, isn't everything discovered? I mean, don't we know what is there?
They're still finding species in Southeast Asia. Yeah.
Well, there's a story I love that the head of the patent office, I think it was about 1900, exclaimed, you know, we might as well close the office because everything that is to be discovered has been discovered.
That's correct, yeah.
So, you know, you look at that and you think, well, 1900, what's been discovered since then?
Not much. I'd like to tell people that uranium was described in a 1900 edition of the Webster's Dictionary as a worthless white metal not found in the United States.
Was it really?
Yeah, that's true. Why is Bigfoot so pissed off in your book?
Well, he has pretty good reason. I think that, to sort of backtrack a little bit on the line of that question, I think Bigfoot is generally pretty shy. I think they're an upper primate, and I think they're pretty intelligent. And I think they stay away from us for good reason. But I do think, because they are an upper life form, they are subject to all sorts of psychological anomalies. I think they're capable of anger, exacting revenge. And in this case, my Bigfoot, the inciting incident is right on the first page where some campers set a fire that gets out of control, becomes a forest fire, and kills his whole tribe. And he decides to exact revenge for that. And then he develops sort of a taste for it. And I think, like serial killers are wont to do, he gets a little careless and he gets into it, and I think it becomes bigger than his original mission. So
now there are people involved in this book also.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are they're like the third crewman in Star Trek who never comes back from the planet surface.
There are plenty of them.
Yeah, that's right. They're like popcorn people. But it was hard for me to figure out who was the greatest monster in this book, Bigfoot or Chris Walker.
Well, that was one of the parallels I wanted to work in there, and I think that, you know, given what happens to Chris, I don't want to give anything away.
Neither do I, but
she
still
had to be pretty bad, so you'd almost maybe feel sorry for her.
Chris Walker's a TV reporter.
Yes,
but she's also the most unscrupulous individual by far in the book. Mm-hmm. And possibly in North America, actually.
I'm glad you appreciated that. was a lot of fun to write, believe me.
I guess she was.
And I did model her after maybe a few people I've known.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So is she your stand-in for, quote-unquote, the media?
Maybe a bit of it. I think the fact she works for the media, and maybe it's a little commentary on that, that the media, you know, my lifetime has changed so much. I think it's... I mean, it's amusing. I watch it. I consume it like everybody else. But I do miss, you know...
Walter Cronkite?
Well, I do. Yeah, Huntley Brinkley, Walter Cronkite, those
people
guys.
With some integrity that reported the news.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I think it's evolved. It's changed. I think you can find good reporting. I think you can find great reporting. You just have to look for it.
Chris, she works for a TV station, and there are people in her TV station who have personal integrity and have some actual
yes.
standards, but she manages somehow to evade them or roll over them. She's pretty ruthless.
Well, I think part of it is she gets ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the name of the game. I mean, it really always has been. Ratings, you know, equal money. But in this case, I think that the media is so mad for, you know, higher ratings and because there's, you know, increased competition that every rating point makes a big difference.
She's not the only person in the book, of course. There's also a guy named Ty Greenwood.
Now, mm-hmm.
He's married to a woman named Veronica.
Yes.
They at one time were very happy, and mm-hmm. they are very, very rich.
Yes.
What happened to Ty Greenwood to put his life into the crapper?
Ty was a happy-go-lucky, really rich guy, made his money in the software business, and he went on a vacation in Idaho, which you see in the early part of the book. And something happens that changes his life. He has an encounter with actually a Bigfoot. It was really sort of playful, probably an adolescent. You know, but to him, he's absolutely terrified because this creature chases him for a while. And I think what happens to him, he has an addictive personality anyway. He has some problems that surface because this event has occurred that changes everything. Now he's sort of driven mad trying to prove that it exists. And he spends a lot of his resources, and finally his wife puts her foot down, and it just, his life goes into the crapper, so to speak.
He's obsessed.
Yes.
And he's obsessed for good reason, because he knows something that not only will nobody believe, but they will ridicule him.
Exactly.
For saying it. It puts a person in extremis, no? A lot of people in this book are in extremis.
Well, I think extreme characters make for more conflict, and conflict is sort of the engine of a good story. Ty is kind of like, I sort of liken him to Wilbur on Mr. Ed.
Right.
You know, the horse talks to him, but he can't convince anybody else that this horse is actually talking. That might tend to drive you a little nuts. Mm-hmm. In this case, it's Bigfoot, and Ty knows it exists. He's seen it. It chased him. It changed everything for him. And yet, and when he finally does have the next encounter, it just, all that obsession just falls away.
Now, he has allies.
Yes.
They have to find each other.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happened is there's a community of belief grows around Ty Greenwood.
Right.
But the catalyst is a guy named Ben Campbell.
Yes.
Tell us about Ben Campbell.
Ben is a Native American. He's 79 years old. He's an actor. He's an actor everybody knows. You know, whenever he goes in someplace, people recognize him. And he's much loved. He's done a series of commercials that people really like, and he's also been in lots and lots of movies. So Ben also has a metaphysical connection to this creature. And Ben, many, many years ago, before he went to World War II, had an encounter in his native woods in Northern California, and something chased him. Not like the one that chased Ty, but this one was Ben on killing Ben. Ben managed to escape, and since then it's obsessed him, and he's had more and more dreams about this thing. And then he develops a connection with the current one, and he knows it's there. He has sort of a mental link with it, and that's sort of how they track it down. Ben eventually joins forces with Ty.
There's an interesting relationship between Ben and the creature.
Yes.
In the sense that the creature at first draws him in, and then after a while becomes a little wary of him because he realizes that, what does he call them? Small two legs.
Small two legs.
All humans are small two legs.
Right.
That this one's a little different.
Yeah, this one can sort of communicate with him, can reach out with its mind voice, I say. In fact, when I'm using his point of view, I tried to write it in a very rudimentary way. He's intelligent, but there's a sort of a crude intelligence. And so he notices that Ben can reach out to him. And yes, he does get wary, and he begins to sort of block that because he doesn't want Ben essentially to know what he's up to.
The creature's very interesting. He's in a sense like the Frankenstein monster, because on a certain level you sympathize with him.
Yeah.
And yet what he does is not very nice.
Yes.
So you have this kind of ambivalent attitude, which becomes less ambivalent as time goes on. But still.
Exactly.
He, the creature has an interesting way of hunting. When he was hunting for food, it was one thing. When he was hunting for revenge, it's another. But what is he able to discern from animals and humans that help him track them?
Well, he can read their emotions. He can sense their thoughts. He can't necessarily interpret exactly what they're thinking. In other words, read their mind and know the words, because he doesn't have that vocabulary. But he can sense their thoughts, their rudimentary emotions.
He can feel fear.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And with an animal, he senses it's more of a dim fear compared to, I say, the sunshine fear of the two small two legs. Because we're much more complex, our fear is different. And so he gets a thrill from that, eventually sort of tormenting people before he kills them. And, of course, he's capable of all sorts of mayhem, being as strong as he is. So and that adds up for some fairly gory scenes.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Matthew Scott Hansen. Matt is the author of The Shadow Killer, published by Simon & Schuster. Did you have some trepidation about attempting to write an inner monologue of a creature that you have no experience with, you know, on a one-to-one basis?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had to...
Did you rewrite it and rewrite it?
I had to think about it a lot before I actually started writing it. But once I began to write it, it was... Yeah, I did go... I rewrite everything, but... In the case of the creature's thoughts, it kind of spilled out once I had a sort of locked him in, and I had a sense of who he was. I came up with his vocabulary, the small two legs, and he talks about days passing as, you know, how many suns, and you know, something, in other words, that I think that you would be able to divine from your environment. You see the sun, when that goes down, it's the dark time.
I love what he calls cars.
Yeah, the hard shells.
Hard shells, yeah.
Yeah. And he doesn't at first, because he hasn't really encountered them that much, know what they are. He thinks they might be alive, and he goes over and sort of tests them out, and he determines they're not really living things. So, I try to write it from his point of view and think. But I think what was most important was keeping him intelligent and a worthy opponent, a worthy adversary, because I think that if you just make him a mindless killing machine, that's no fun. If you make him dimensional, if you make him a worthy adversary, capable of all sorts of cunning and abilities to, take down his opponent, which in this case is the protagonist and his friends, then you don't know that they're going to win. So I think there's some tension there.
We have two cops. When you have a series of murders, certainly the cops, these are sheriff's homicide deputies,
right.
Detectives, I mean, that show up. Well, one is a guy named Max Schneider.
Yes.
You know, there's a guy named Carl Carrillo or Carrillo.
Carrillo, right.
Yeah. And they're partners, but they're really different. Talk a little bit about Mac and Carl.
Well, Mac is goes by his instincts, his gut instincts. He was with the LAPD for some time and worked in a pretty tough division. And he's sort of an unconventional guy. He doesn't really hang out with his brethren in law enforcement. His thought processes are different. He's a sensitive guy. He's just sort of on his own. On the other hand, he's very friendly and he commands respect from everybody he works with. Excuse me. Carrillo, on the other hand, is kind of a straight ahead guy. More of a little more macho, I guess you'd call him. And he's sort of a kind of guy that would use a hammer instead of a rapier or a, you know, whatever analogy you want to come up with. So,
yeah. Yeah, rapier like it doesn't describe Carrillo at all.
No.
It's always bad when partners have a falling out. And if I tread too heavily on the plot here, you have to tell me. But in essence, Mac becomes a believer and Carl just cannot go there. Not only that, but Mac can't even talk about it.
No.
He feels like Ty Green did.
Well, I think what happens is Mac realizes that the climate within the department is just not going to allow him to come out and say, hey, Bigfoot's doing it. Because in a way, he knows politically that's stupid. But also, he doesn't 100% believe it. He just can't quite bring himself to it. He's kind of like Doubting Thomas. He needs to put his hands in the wounds. And I think, of course, when he, you know, when it finally happens and he does see it, you know, there's that split second. Of course, it was there. How could I have doubted this? And but I think that's what's holding him back. His lack of, you know, true belief, 100% investment in the idea. And of course, you know, he knows no one will believe him. So,
do you want to talk about the footprints?
Sure.
Okay, tell us, I guess the footprints are Mac's first clue that things may not be everything they seem to be. Tell us about the footprints.
Well, they find an enormous footprint. It's a perfect impression. And Mac is stupefied. Mac, of course, his thought processes are a little different than Carrillo. He thinks it's what it is. You know, sort of like Occam's razor. You know, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one. And he brings Carrillo over. Carrillo's immediate reaction is, who faked this? Why would they fake it? Because he just, you know, the idea of Bigfoot actually existing is just not within his realm of belief.
It's not an irrational response.
Exactly. No, absolutely not. I think there are a lot of people who tend to think that way. And so Mac sort of keeps quiet, but they do take a casting of it, and they take it back to the department, and They show it to their bosses, who have the same reaction as Carrillo. So Mac realizes at that point, I better keep my yap shut. And so, although they do have the physical evidence now, they have the giant casting of this footprint, this enormous 20-inch footprint. And Mac eventually takes it sort of behind their back to an anthropologist at the University of Washington, who takes a look at it. And he's a little guarded because he's been sideswiped by a tabloid reporter. And
he was a really interesting character because he wants to believe, but he has a grant coming up.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to, you know, let his butt hang out in public if he's because he's afraid of his grant. This sounds absolutely real to me. Yeah. And I kept thinking, is there really a guy he knows who's like this?
Well, he's a, you know, I created him out of a number of different characters. I mean, even going back to horror movies that I loved in the 50s, where you always had the scientist who was really good for exposition. He could tell you, well, here's what the creature is. It's a so-and-so, you know, and give you the history on it. In this case, he goes into some detail. But
so
yeah,
he's the geek in the white coat.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah. And yes, he does have. He's up for review, and he's got, you know, this potential new job, and you know, he's got his community of fellow anthropologists who sort of look down on him. And you know, it's an interesting parallel with Dr. Jeff Meldrum, who's at Idaho State, that some of his fellow professors have ganged up and tried to get him either to not get tenure or to get his tenure rescinded.
Well, for those of us who don't know who Jeff Meldrum is, give us a...
Dr. Meldrum is a he's a well-known anthropologist, a great, brilliant guy. I've never met him, but I've read his work, and he's very studious, very scientific, and this guy has approached the notion of Bigfoot existing very scientifically, just like the late Dr. Grover Krantz did at my alma mater, Washington State. And here you had two guys, two scientists, who came forward and said, here's the evidence. Here's what we have. Let's analyze it. Let's not get all excited. Let's not, you know, get in a dither. And, you know, here is how we can draw a line between, you know, with this thing that existed, Gigantopithecus, and what we have today, scientifically. And there's plenty of evidence. There's the foot castings. There's the Patterson-Gimlin film from 1967.
Never been debunked?
No.
Because a lot of... somebody just died last year.
Yeah, Ray Wallace, a couple of years, five years ago.
And did he admit, see, my memory's failing here, did he admit that he had faked the film?
Oh, I think he told people on a number of occasions what I've heard, yes. And I think that when he died, his family came out, his kids said, yeah, he was responsible for it. But I think they're just trying to preserve their dad's memory, I understand that. The film, if you look at it... a number of people have tried to debunk it, said I was the guy in the suit. But if you look past the people who are trying to lay those crazy claims, it's been given to special effects people since, obviously it was shot 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago.
Oh, this is in the last, that afterword in the book. I found that very interesting. You know, talk about
that. Well, just in the last few years, it was given to special effects people. And of course, effects now are so wildly different than what they were 40 years ago. And biomechanists, it's been given anthropologists, all these people looking at this thing. And when you look at this creature walking, usually the film that people see is probably fourth or fifth generation down. It's a little blurry. The actual one that Patterson shot is relatively sharp, sharper than most people have seen. More details visible. You can see the muscles moving under the fur or the hair. The hair has got a mottled effect that looks more natural than if it were manufactured or created out of a yak suit or something like that. There are a lot of things. The way it moves, for instance, when the creature turns to the camera, human beings, we can swivel our head on our shoulders. We can look over our shoulder. An ape can't, because its neck is shorter, it's down below, its chin is below its shoulder level, so it literally has to turn its entire upper body, and that's what this creature does. The locomotion of the creature has been analyzed by experts, and the way it moves. You could teach a human being to walk that way, but would they have known that in 1967? Would Patterson and Gimlin, who didn't really have a whole lot of money, would they have been able to perpetrate such an outrageous hoax that's been analyzed by all these people? In 1967, they took it to Universal Pictures, to the special effects department. This is when they had in-house effects departments. Now they're all independent. And the guys at Universal, this was about the time they shot Planet of the Apes. And so state-of-the-art ape effects were known. These guys looked at it and said, well, if you gave us a couple of million, we could try, but we can't guarantee it, because this thing is just, you know, you've got muscles moving. And the other thing, too, about the Patterson creature is a lot of people don't realize it, but it's a female. It has enormous pendulous breasts. And if you were going to fake it, why would you create something as anatomically difficult to duplicate like that? Why would you do that? It just doesn't make any sense.
This, of course, leads to the question, the Bigfoot community. And there is a Bigfoot community.
Oh, yes.
There. What's the response been to this book?
You know, I was unsure when I wrote the book. I thought, because many of them, like I believe, that they're benign creatures, but I thought maybe they would take exception to the fact I made him a homicidal maniac. But he has good reason. I think I gave him pretty good motivation. And so I've been surprised that they've been just overwhelmingly excited by this book. And I think they realize that I've done an enormous amount of research. I've been fascinated with Bigfoot ever since I was a kid growing up in Eugene. And the reports started coming out of Northern California. I was probably 5 years old. And so ever since then, I've just, you know, this is something I've just been fascinated by. And I thought for my first novel, I've written other books, nonfiction, but I thought for my first novel, I wanted to write this book. It was something I felt I just had it in me. So
I have one last question. I was thinking about this on the way over here today to talk to you. If you had written a nonfiction book about Bigfoot, it would have gone on the shelves with the Ouija board books and the I Was Abducted by Aliens books.
Yeah.
If you write a novel, they have to deal with it on a whole different level. Did you think about this before you wrote the book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There are other books, there are other terrific nonfiction books that analyze what Bigfoot is and their anecdotes, and there are a lot of great ones out there. There are, in terms of fiction, not as many.
Not Harry and the Hendersons, for sure. You make reference to that in the book.
I like the movie, but you know that and that may actually be what Bigfoot's more like than mine. But anyway, I think mine could happen. You know, the creature that I created, I think that could happen.
Well, finally, I'd like to remind our listeners one more time that I've been speaking with Matthew Scott Hansen, Hansen. The Shadow Killer is the title of the book, a book about Bigfoot, published by Simon & Schuster. Matt, come back again with your next book.
Absolutely, I will. Thank you very much.